Hey, I'm Ruben. My band and I have a new song. I'm also a tow truck driver. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I get to go home at the end of the day and see my bandmates.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate lightweight, super packable travel shoes from Allbirds. Find your perfect pair at allbirds.com. That's allbirds.com.
We're outside the travel agency, a cannabis store that's got everyone buzzing.
When I walked in, I felt like I was in the elite of the skies, like I'm about to get elevated and lifted in the best way. Got the important essential things. I need sleep, so tinctures, salves to relax my body, right? The best New York flowers.
Come down to the travel agency and see for yourself. For use only by adults age 21 and older. Keep out of reach of children and pets. In case of accidental ingestion or overconsumption, contact the National Poison Control Center. Consume responsibly.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Fred Rosen is a former columnist for the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times. He is also one of the most important and successful figures in true crime writing, and the author of several true crime classics. He got off to an incredible start with Lobster Boy in 1995, Blood Crimes in 1996, and Gang Mum and the Mad Chopper, both published in 1998. Deacon of Death was published in 2000, Needlework in 2001. Both Body Dump and Flesh Collectors were published in 2002. The Historical Atlas of American Crime in 2005. When Satan Wore a Cross and There But for the Grace of God were both published in 2007. Deadly Angel in 2009 and Trails of Death in 2011. Did They Really Do It was published in 2015. Born to the Mob and Murdering the President were published in 2016, The Bayou Strangler in 2017, and Bat Masterson in 2019. We will discuss how he got started and what cases and killers in particular most shaped his remarkable true crime body of work. The episode tonight is Fred Rosen, True Crime Retrospective. My special guest, journalist and author, Fred Rosen. Welcome back to the program. And thank you very much for this, Fred Rosen.
Oh, Dan, I'm overwhelmed. I really am. I mean, as you were reading off those books, you know, it brings back all these memories, you know?
Well, that's good. Yes.
Well, you know what's interesting? When you look back on a book, and you know this, when you look back at a book, you don't remember necessarily... Yeah, I mean, you remember some of the details about the case, depending upon what the case is, but you also remember what was going on personally, you know,
sure,
in your life.
Sure. Let's talk about the books in particular. As I mentioned in the introduction, sure, you got off to an incredible start with Lobster Boy. Now, where were you previous to Lobster Boy in your career? And give us the particulars, the circumstances in which... This
okay.
book, very important true crime classic, with the wildest cover in true crime history. Tell us about
that.
Lobster Boy. Tell us about the genesis of Lobster Boy and your career as a result.
Okay, thank you. I'll tell you what happened. I had actually done another true crime book prior to that called Doctors from Hell.
Right.
And what happened was... And what happened was I was trying to sell a novel, and I got friendly for various reasons, you know, with this editor. His name is Paul Dennis, who really shaped a lot of true crime at Pinnacle Books.
Right.
And he, and I was standing on the corner of Park Avenue and 34th Street in the middle of Manhattan, Dan. And he said to me, well, you know what? I don't want to publish your novel, but I'd like you to work on this book called Doctors from Hell. I need a journalist. And I was teaching journalism at the time, okay, at Hofstra University. So, he offered me, you know, I remember the wind, you know, it was almost like a, what do you call it, a spiritual moment. You know, I was thinking, you know, do I do this? Because it wasn't something that I was necessarily looking to do. It was an opportunity. And I went with it. And then what happened? Lobster Boy. Okay, shortly after I do that book, oh, man, I'm in Florida. I was on vacation, and I saw something in the local paper about a case involving a lobster boy. And I'm going, right. Okay. And I called up Paul Dennis, the editor, and I said, you know, this is a weird case. He says, it's your next book. So what? he says, it's your next book. Okay. It's my next book. So I start looking into it, and what happened was Brady Stiles Jr., who's Lobster Boy, was a carny freak who had ectodactyly, which is what caused the feet and the hands to fuse and give him what looked like lobster claws.
Okay.
He was abusive to his family, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, long story short, his wife working with her son, who is his stepson, Grady's stepson, they hire a hitman to come into the house and kill him. Well, the attorney for the wife sent out a videotape, and it was supposed to be used in her defense. And what it shows is Lobster Boy wrestling with his son, Lobster Boy Jr. Okay.
Right.
And I get a copy of it, Dan. I don't know if I ever talked about this. I don't think I have. And I get a copy of it, and I, you know, and I listen to it. You know, I play, you know, this is back in the 90s, so it's video. And what you hear in the background is kibitzing. I think I have to translate that, huh?
Right.
Kibitzing is a Yiddish term for kidding around. You hear the family kidding around in the background. Okay. Fade out, fade in. I go to the trial. I'm at the trial. And during the trial, the defense attorney shows the tape, except he turns down the sound. And it's silent. I didn't know he turned it down. I found that out later. But when you look at it without sound, it looks like the father's abusing the son.
Right.
So what does your buddy do? He walks up to the prosecutor. I walk up to the prosecutor and I said, my copy of the tape has sound and there's kibitzing. And he says, get me a copy of it. Send it. It's evidence in a murder case. Oh my God, you know, this was, I'm going, what the hell do I do, Dan? You know, mm-hmm. I'm getting involved in a murder case directly, and, you know, usually journalists don't do those things. And, you know, we report, we don't get involved. Well, I'll tell you what, so I had to decide. I mean, I got the tape. And you were asking what I was doing at that time. I was still teaching, but get this. I get the tape, okay? I'm in a hotel room in Tampa, and I get a phone call, and it's from the school I was teaching at. They're telling me I'm not getting tenure because my degree is in film. It's not in journalism. I'm not qualified to continue teaching. And I look at the tape, and I'm going, okay, I'm not qualified to teach journalism, but I'm about to break a major murder case. And I had to decide what to do with the tape then. It was one of the most pivotal moments in my life because I knew if I turned it over, she'd get convicted. And I was putting my life at risk. So I didn't know what to do, and I sat in the room. I looked out the window, and I went back to my childhood. And I thought, what would the Lone Ranger do? Because he was, And so I said the Lone Ranger would turn over the tape and would serve justice regardless of the consequences. And that's always been the way that I functioned, you know, in terms of the way I work. And so that's what happened. I turned the tape over, and sure enough, I got a threat from the family, but thank God nothing happened. And
Were you criticized by the media at all with your stance?
Oh yeah, there were some people that criticized me. Yeah. Yeah. But the funny thing is, Dan, as sensational as this sounds, it didn't get very much in the way of national publicity.
Really?
I don't know. Yeah, and now it could be because it was the mid-90s, and, you know, it's different today, obviously. I mean, you know, but no. There were some people that criticized me, but I just rolled with the punches.
The publisher, Pinnacle, at the time, must have been pretty happy with the results. And so you get to your next book in 1996, Blood Crimes.
Oh, yeah.
When Brian Freeman and his 15-year-old brother murdered their entire family, well, their mother, father, and younger brother, and these are neo-Nazi skinheads. Tell us just something that comes to mind with this, your second book, Blood Crimes.
I'll tell you what comes to mind. They were the brothers were Jehovah's Witnesses, so they rebelled against the parents by becoming skinheads. It's weird. But they got friendly when they escaped after they did the killing. They went up to Michigan, and they with some white supremacist friends. What happens during the trial, which is in Allentown, Pennsylvania, their white supremacist friend, skinhead friend, comes down to testify. And, I'm sitting here and I got to stop myself from laughing so much because what happens is I started talking to him. You know, I'm a reporter. And, you know, of course, I'm thinking to myself, gee, Fred, it's a little bit weird, a Jewish guy talking to a neo-Nazi, blah, blah, blah. But I said, you know what? I'm working. And I talked to the guy. He says, oh, I need a lift to the airport. I drove the neo-Nazi to the airport, and we hit it off. It was very interesting because he gave me information about the brothers.
Yeah, amazing.
And the other thing that was interesting about that was that because I had lived in Brooklyn Heights, a section of Brooklyn, a neighborhood in Brooklyn, and that is where the Jehovah's Witnesses are based. That's where they have their world headquarters. So I was very familiar with witnesses.
Okay. Let's talk about Gang Mom. This is very interesting case of incredible deception. Was Mary Louise Thompson, mother of a troubled teen. She had been become an active campaigner against teen gang activity. What did the neighbors find out about the model mother?
The neighbors found out it was Eugene, Washington, that she was running her own street gang. That while she was coming across publicly as an advocate against gangs, she had her own gang. And she running her own gang. And eventually, her son, what happens is she winds up getting one member of the gang to kill a boy, a teenager, that's going to testify against her son in a case.
Yeah.
And that's why she winds up going to jail for life. You know, yeah. And this is the Pacific Northwest. They don't kid around with these things. You know what I mean? They're very, you know, it's not someplace you're going to get away with something like that.
What do you remember about the Mad Chopper, Tampa, Florida?
Oh boy. I'll tell you what I remember about the Mad Chopper. Oh boy. I had to take two trips. I always go to the scene of the crime. Always.
Right.
And so the first trip was down to Florida, where he killed murdered a prostitute. But then I went out to California, because the reason he was called the Mad Chopper is it's awful. He chopped, he kidnapped a young girl and chopped off her arm.
Yeah.
And I mean, he wound up getting, a lot of years in prison. And I wound up going up to, I actually went up to Northern California, to the area where it happened. You know, I went to the scene of the crime, and I talked to I remember Modesto. I had to go to Modesto, and I talked to the police officer there, who was the detective on the case. It was a very, very upsetting case, because the girl, oh God, you know, she never recovered. You know, I mean, sure, she got, you know, an artificial arm, but, you know, emotionally, forget about it.
The interesting thing was she testified at trial, though, remarkably.
Yeah.
She was able
to. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but it was. The mere fact that the law and they changed it afterwards. I know they changed it afterwards. They let the guy out was ridiculous. I mean, it was really, really ridiculous. And when they did let him out, no community would take him. You know, they had to move him around.
Incredible.
Yeah.
You have a couple, again, wolves in sheep's clothing, pardon me, a couple remarkable stories involving something that people would not believe if it were not for, they would believe, it would have a hard time believing if it was fictional. This Deacon of Death, Church Deacon Sam Smithers, this is in Tampa.
Yeah.
By day, he's the church deacon, but what's he doing at night, and what does
it lead to? Well, I also have a memory on that book, too. What happens is, what Sam is doing is at night, he leaves his house, and he picks up girls along one, you know, the street that Hillsborough, I think it's Hillsborough Avenue, where prostitutes, he'll do that on the way to work, blah, 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 stuff like that. But eventually he picks up two girls and he transports them to this house where he's the caretaker someplace out in the country, and he murders both of them and dumps them in a, what do you call it? A pond.
Right.
And dumps them in a pond. And, it was, and what happened was that both of the women were prostitutes. And what happens is, it must have been about a couple of years afterwards. I mean, Facebook is amazing, Dan, sometimes, because I started getting, PMs, the personal message, from
right.
a prostitute who'd been working the streets with one of them. And she started telling me about the woman, and basically what she's telling me is she's lucky she didn't wind up that way.
Right.
It was really amazing. You know, once in a while those things happen. You know, not very often where somebody talks to you after the fact. You know, after the case, but that was very upsetting. And, that was very upsetting. But you see, you've also mentioned a lot of those earlier cases took place in Tampa, Florida, in that area, Hillsborough County, because that's where Lops of the Boy took place. Even though it was pretty far south in the county, but basically what happened was I formed a relationship with the police officers and also with the public information officer. So I'd ask them to let me know if they had any interesting cases, and they would.
Talk about interesting cases. When Satan wore a cross, this is 1980 in Toledo, Ohio, and
yeah.
Again, on one of the holiest days of the church calendar, you write, the body of a nun was discovered in the sacristy of a hospital chapel. 71-year-old sister Margaret Ann been strangled and stabbed, and here it goes, her corpse arranged in a shameful and stomach-churning, to say the least, pose. Police had a suspect, Father Gerald Robinson. Tell us what happens here, and then what happens 23 years later in this incredible story.
Well, what happens is that Robinson is interrogated originally, but the Monsignor comes in and gets him out. You know, the church used its influence and got him out. And then they moved him around from parish to parish. And funny thing on that case is, as I got into it, there was a cop, a former cop, who had been at the crime scene, and he had been, blacklisted. He had been blacklisted by the department because he didn't go with their take on the thing.
Right.
So, I forgot. one more thing, as Colombo used to say. This is the first time I ever spoke to an exorcist.
Wow.
Dan, I got on the phone with an exorcist.
Jeez.
And, you know, because they called in an exorcist and to help them figure out what was going on, because it was a satanic inspired crime. And then so I got to talk to the exorcist, you know. That was pretty interesting.
Yes, no kidding. what was interesting too is that 23 years later, really what we had and what you write about, which I thought was very interesting, was that it was a different time in, you know, it was 23 years later, but the societal shift in attitude was really what facilitated Robinson being convicted, because it was a different, completely different time. Like you say, the church didn't have the power that it had with the exposing of all the scandals over the years in that interim.
Oh, yeah. And that was what was so interesting about it. And in fact, Robinson died in jail a couple of years ago. Somebody contacted me to let me know about it.
Interesting. You wrote a book called There But for the Grace of God. Tell us just what that is briefly. What do you mean by There But for the Grace of God? What do you include?
Well, it's based on that old expression. Help me out here. There But for the Grace of God is about, oh boy, this is the most emotional book I ever did. No
really?
Question. Oh, yeah. I mean, this was a book I interviewed survivors of serial killers. And it was a real education. In fact, one of the survivors, who I'm not going to mention by name, but found a way to make money off of it. But I've got to say that what was so hard, oh man, I'll never forget this. I met the woman who was in the woman who put Ted Bundy in the chair.
Okay.
It was when Bundy went into the sorority house in Florida. Central Florida, and this woman had come in after Bundy had killed two of her sorority sisters upstairs, and she came into the ante room, but it would be the living room, and she said to me she could feel her grandfather's arm on her, stopping her from going further into the room. Because if she'd gone further into the room, she would have been close to Bundy and he might have killed her. But she was able
right.
to see him. And
right. yeah.
at the stairs in a circle of light, pool of light, whatever. And what happened was she later testified against him and put him in the electric chair. But I got to tell you, the emotion, I have never, ever been that close to that kind of evil. I mean, I don't mean to get, you know, mystical or anything, but I just have to tell you that the vibe was just, I could feel the Bundy vibes, and I'm just talking to this woman, you know, and luckily she survived and had a life and so forth and so on. That was just very, very emotional.
Tell us how you came to be involved and write Deadly Angel, a crime that occurred in Wasilla, Alaska, a little place, about 4,200 people. She was an exotic dancer at this Bush company in nearby Anchorage. Tell us a little bit about what you remember about this.
Well, the thing I got to tell you about that is that the woman, okay, this is about an exotic dancer who allegedly lures one of the guys she's living with out into the country and murders him. Thing is, later on, this became the first closed case that the closed case squad in that area of and the state police handled, okay, but
right.
She actually was later found, her conviction was overturned by the, what do you call it, you know, the appeals court.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as the, you know, courts are concerned, she's not guilty.
There was no follow-up to this? I mean, normally, even Pinnacle had a sort of a rule, didn't they? Didn't they have, if this is a Pinnacle release, didn't they have a rule to wait till those appeals were exhausted? What was it that,
was there new evidence
brought up later? Was it circumstances?
It was circumstances, but also the, this wasn't Pinnacle, this was HarperCollins.
Okay.
And this was different. I have to tell you that this was at a different point in my career. It was all I can say is it was different. Okay. And in terms of appeals, now that you mention it, yeah, you got a good point there. Usually, you wait until everything is adjudicated before you publish. But this is what happened. But of course, it took years. You know, that's the other thing. It took years. And I remember that it was the stripper in the case. She came from Jersey.
Yeah.
It's amazing how you remember those things. She came from New Jersey, but it was. I didn't go. That's a case where I did not go to. I've been to Alaska, but I didn't go to Alaska on that. Maybe if I had, you know, I would have realized, you know, the legal problems, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had an experience with a particularly evil serial killer. They are all, I guess, a certain amount of evil, but this, Hilton,
oh boy.
Gary Michael Hilton. Trails of Death. What do you remember about this guy that struck in Florida, Georgia, and North Carolina before he was finally caught?
I got to just say a couple of things about this. First, you know, you always, when you, I, you know, except for like podcasts, which of course this is, you don't expect a tape of an interview that you, well, To stay around. I did an interview in 2011 with Dateline NBC on this case, and they rebroadcast it a week ago last Friday.
Wow.
And the thing about Hilton that was different for me than any other, well, yeah, I think it probably different than certainly any other serial killer case, but any I think any other case that I'd done is what happened was I got friendly with one of his childhood friends in Hialeah, Florida, not too far from where I live now. So, Dan, I went over to Hialeah, and his friend took me. Oh, man, he took me down the canals they used to go down as kids. He took me to where they played as kids. And when I added it all up, okay, I see the guy's background. I talked to his friend. I researched his background and found out that he'd gone through a certain amount of abuse, okay. And I sat behind him. Oh man, Dan, I sat behind the guy in court. I mean, the only thing between us was the railing.
Right.
So I could hear all of his conversations with his attorney and stuff like that, Hilton. And I have to tell you that this was the first time I was in a courtroom where a man was sentenced to death. I'd never experienced that. And I'll be quite frank and say, when I walked out of that courtroom after that happened, I shed a few tears. And the reason I shed a few tears is because it was pretty obvious from when the defense argued for the guy's life, how he'd been abused, how he had brain problems, he'd had some brain damage. You know, this was actually it was very interesting. And so I felt badly. You know, I felt like...
Hi, I'm Josie. My daughter turns 5 today. I'm also an Ohio State Highway Patrol trooper. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can get home to celebrate with my daughter.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
You know, I don't know. You know, just the idea, you know, help. But, however, look, and then what happened with that one? Here we go, Facebook again. Somebody contacts me on Facebook who was a friend of his, who's in Florida and goes and sees him every now and then. So I've said to myself now for a couple of years, gee, do you want to visit him? Because I never did an interview. And I don't know where I go with it, Dan. You know?
Right.
Where do you go with it? You visit a convicted serial killer in jail. The book's already out. What am I
going to
write about?
It? Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
You know?
Sure.
So I don't know.
Yeah. Let's talk about flesh collectors. Well, you call
Ooh.
It Misfit Jeremy Rogers, 21, and racist devil worshiper Jonathan Lawrence, 23. They met in a Florida penal system mental hospital. So
right.
A relationship made in true crime heaven. Let's 1998 in Pensacola, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Leighton Smitherman. What happens with these guys and why? What are these guys really all about as you write?
Well, these guys are they're weird. I mean, even for killers, they're weird. One of them seems to be into the devil, what they do is first when they fire at Smitherman, it's sort of a random thing. But then, eventually, they wind up killing the cousin of one of these two killers.
Right.
Because and that's really the sad part. What happens is one of them goes out on a date with a girl and it's really sad. He picks her up at her house and the guy's got tattoos all over his body, but he's all clothed. Because when he picks the girl up, the mother is there. And the girl is just like, I think she was 18. She was just about to graduate. And what happens is they take her out into the country. I mean, these two guys, I think this is one of those situations where those two personalities became very, working together became very deadly.
Yeah,
and And so they one of them shoots her, and then the other one, oh boy, he uses a knife and he cuts up her calf muscle. Like he's gonna, and then when Todd Hand, who's the detective, comes into their when he goes to arrest them and he comes into their trailer, he finds the flesh in the refrigerator.
Remarkable, incredible.
Incredible. I mean, just incredible, but very evil people. You know, like when we were talking a couple of minutes ago about Gary Hilton. I wouldn't call Gary evil, okay? Bad maybe, but these two guys, oh man, they're off the charts, and they're just off the charts, and it was very, very upsetting. And of course, I went to the I traveled to Pensacola to it's across from Pensacola. And it's the Redneck Riviera. That's where I first learned that the coast of Florida and New Mexico, you call it the Redneck Riviera.
Wow.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Fred.
No, I was just going to say, I just remember that when I covered that case, a hurricane hit. And a hurricane hit, and a tree came down right near me. So I feel very lucky, you know, that I got out of that one alive.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to talk about our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. FabFitFun is a woman's lifestyle subscription box filled with full-size, premium beauty, lifestyle, fitness, home, and wellness products sent straight to your doorstep each season. They take the hassle out of shopping by doing it for you, with each box customized to your specific interests. The winter box is the perfect way to treat yourself or others and get yourself ready for the season with their carefully curated box of products. This box is everything you need to have a great winter. Save money on quality, full-size products today because these deals can't last long. These boxes sell out fast, so sign up for yours today. My wife, Lisa, was very excited to get her first ever FabFitFun box, and she still is very excited every time she's going to get a new FabFitFun box. She loves that most of the items in the box are customizable, with a great selection to pick from to fit your unique needs and interests. Lisa discovered the original makeup eraser, and she says she can't live without it now, and the goat milk moisturizing cream from Kate Somerville, she says, is amazing. She also loves Prep Rally Prime and Prep Detangler by Drybar. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box with full-size beauty, fitness, fashion, and lifestyle products. It retails for $49.99, but always has a value over $200. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com/murder. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Now, Fred, we were talking, or about to talk about, one of the books that you, in the 18 books that we're featuring today, Did They Really Do It? Tell us a little bit about the genesis of this book and what you cover in this book,
oh,
kind of cases.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I have a very strong interest, as you know, Dan, in history, American history, and
sure.
And so I was interested in cases in American history where maybe there was some doubt about whether the bad guy did it or not, and I had to pick the cases. Okay, and one of the cases that was pretty easy was the bomber. I'm sorry. No, the guy that was allegedly involved with the World Trade Center bombing. But the point is, when I was working on the cases, there was one case that really got to me. It was Dr. Samuel Mudd. A lot of people don't remember this, but Dr. Mudd was a doctor in Maryland who went after John Wilkes Booth shot President Lincoln, escaped, and he wound up coming to Mudd's house to get his ankle set. Well, the question was, did Mudd know Booth before? Did he have any idea that what Booth was going to do? So I start doing my research, Dan, and I find that there was a letter that Jimmy Carter, our former president, sent to the grandson of Dr. Mudd in the late 70s, where he said to him, well, I think he's innocent, but I can't pardon him because it's not federal or something along those lines. And he actually was correct. He couldn't pardon him because it was a military trial. But
right.
The first question, what's the question? Why did Jimmy Carter write a letter? Why did he say that? So what happens? I'll never forget this. I get on the phone and I call up the Carter Center in Atlanta, and they said I had a question for the president. This is about history, and they said, okay, fax it in. He's in town. I said, he's in town? He's not in Plains? They said, no, he's here. I said, okay, so I fax in the question, Dan. Within 5 days, I go to the mailbox. I open my mailbox, and there's a letter. And there's no stamp on it. I went, wait a minute. Only presidents have franking privileges. Sure enough, on the back, it says Jimmy Carter.
Wow.
I open it up, Dan. Carter took my fax and wrote me a note. And he said, dear Fred, I did what my people told me to do.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, what former president would say I messed up that way and get back to you so fast except Jimmy Carter, you know?
Yeah.
And,
wow.
And because he did mess up, and this is important, because at Dr. Mudd's trial, his slaves testified that Booth had shown up prior to getting his ankle set. So he knew him. And Mudd wound up going to the Dry Tortugas, which is down here off the coast of Florida, and he was pardoned because they had a yellow fever epidemic, and he helped out. But the fact is, he sure as heck knew what was going to go on, and he sure as heck knew John Wilkes Booth.
Incredible.
So that, yeah, and that was what was so interesting about that book. In terms of the cases,
let's go to the Bayou Strangler. 97 bodies of young African American men began turning up in the cane fields of New Orleans suburbs. You had direct access to this investigation and Dominique's confession, and you went and explored this community here to be able to write this story, the Bayou Strangler. Tell us just a little tidbit about the Bayou Strangler.
Okay. This is about a guy named Ronald J. Dominique, and he is Remember the kill totals, but he.
You're breaking up, Fred. Sorry. Can you repeat that again?
He murdered 23 men, and I was taken by the investigating officer, a woman, to all of the dump sites where the guy dumped his bodies. That was something. I mean, it wasn't. Talking to you, what it really comes down to is, if you're going to write a true crime book, in a sense, you're being a detective, you know. And and I was taken to the dump sites, and I'll tell you, it was very, very emotional. The fact of that he had picked on gay or bisexual men. And that was what was so interesting, was that because he did, the case got very little national publicity. Nobody wanted to publicize it because, at least at that point they didn't. Maybe it would be different today. I don't know. But when they finally formed their task force to get the guy, it really pushed things, they got things going. But that was also very upsetting. But I got to tell you something. The cop on the case, she took me in. She took me out for lunch, and we went to this lunch place we're rural Louisiana, right on the Gulf, and there were all these other cops there, and they said, "Oh, why don't you try this?" I said, "What's that?" They said, "French fried alligator." They wanted to see what my response was going to be, and of course I knew I was being, tested. This was a case where the cops did a very, very, they did a great job. They really did a great job, because if they hadn't gotten this guy, he'd still be out there.
Yeah, and he was, as you write, he was flying under the radar for years. He was working as a pizza delivery man and a meter reader. He didn't fit anybody's profile, did he?
No, not at all. And not only that, he didn't do what you would have thought a serial killer would do in the bayou, which is dump the bodies in the bayou. He didn't do that. He dumped them by the side of the road. There was certainly certainly an element of ego involved in this. Certainly an element of ego involved in it.
Tell us about, I know this is close to home to you, this is more recent books for you, Murdering the President.
Ooh.
James Garfield, shot by Charles Guiteau. Tell us about the history books, what they did say, and what you found, contrary to that.
What happened was, the history books all say that President Garfield died from a wound by the fellow Guiteau, who shot him. And it happens that when I first started writing, researching this, is when I did my Atlas of Crime, I got a hold of, and this goes back to 15 years, 16 years, whatever, I got a hold of a scientific journal in which Alexander Graham Bell writes about inventing the world's first metal detector in 1881 to find the bullet in the president's body. And I'm going, oh, that's real interesting. So, I kept going with the research. But what I did was, I ran the doctor's name through all the computer databases. And what do I find out? The guy's a con man. The guy claimed to have a cure for cancer. He was a coward in battle. Most importantly, he claimed that the bullet was on the left side of the president's body. He claimed this publicly. And so when Dr. Bell invents the world's first metal detector, and Alexander Graham Bell goes to the White House and with the doctor to use the machine on the president, and what happens? The doctor won't let Bell.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Use the machine on the side of the body where he said the bullet isn't, because he didn't want to look bad. He didn't want him to find the bullet, and then he would look bad. So the wind up after that is Garfield is dying from bullet, from blood poisoning, and the doctor keeps operating without. Scrubbing his hands, even though at that point sepsis was something that was coming into vogue. Well,
right.
Garfield gets the blood poisoning, and the doctor, and then the other thing is, oh boy, this guy decides to give the president of the United States a nutritious enema. I'm cleaning it up. And where he's going to pump stuff up into his rectum that contains vitamins, stuff like that, you know, soup. It's a way
soup.
He pumps soup into his rectum. It's ridiculous. He thinks that the body will absorb it. Basically, he was torturing the president. That's what he was doing. And the other thing is, you know, this was a book that I felt a personal attachment to, because through circumstance, I had gotten friendly with the president's great 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 grandson, Hank Garfield.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd hit it off. And so I felt like a responsibility, Dan, because
sure.
This is my friend's family. You know, it's amazing, you know, some of the things that you wind up working on that you'd never think you'd work on.
Certainly. Tell us about the historical atlas of American crime. What is it?
What happened was I wanted to write a history book. And, in fact, I just got the rights back to the book. I just have to find somebody to publish it. And I decided to take a different look at crime in America. I decided to look at crime in America from the point of view of how crime spread across the continent as the United States did, and what influenced crime, such as technology, medicine, communications. And I dealt with all of those things in this book, in terms of how they influence certain crimes.
Let's talk about needlework.
Ooh. Needlework. Oh, boy. What? Aside from the fact that the plane that I was supposed to take a plane I was supposed to take from Newark Airport was delayed because of weather, Dan. And
right.
I'm walking through the airport, and because I'm going to get on a plane to Michigan. I'm walking through the airport, and who do I see in front of me? What's his name? He played Captain Sisko on Star Trek: The Next Generation. What's his name?
Can't help you.
Well, anyway, what happens is, I want to walk up to the guy and say, "Gee, can you beam us out of here?" But luckily I didn't, because he had a really scowl on his face. So anyway, I wound up the next day going to Michigan, and I think that was the first time I went to Michigan, and that was an interesting one because it's about this couple, it's actually about a triangle. It's a romantic triangle. This woman is married to a drug dealer. He sets up shop down the block from the police department, and because he figures nobody will know it's him. And his wife gets involved with a guy, and eventually what happens is they, working together, give the husband a hot shot of heroin, which kills him. He was a diabetic, instead of giving him the insulin. And then there's a woman who's a friend of hers, and she learns about some of this stuff, and they wind up killing her, and then they've got to then transport her body to another part of Michigan and burn it, and you know, stuff like that. So that was a very that was in some ways almost a straightforward case, in the sense that the police were very helpful. Both there were two police departments, but in fact, I think I recently got contacted. I tried following through one more time on Facebook. The woman that went to jail had two kids, and one of those kids is now an adult and contacted me through Facebook, and I was trying to follow up, but nothing's happened yet.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Amazing the contact you do get after these books, and even if it is years later, these books still get people's attention in order for people
yeah.
like this to come forward.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Body Dump, October 1996. You say women began vanishing off the streets of Poughkeepsie, New York, all young, pretty, and petite. But most were hustlers and crackheads, you say, unfortunately.
Yes.
The death toll was 8 victims. What do you remember about Body Dump?
What I remember about Body Dump is the fact that this case took place near where I was living. I was living in Woodstock, New York. This was across the river in Poughkeepsie. And so I was actually able to go. It was very easy in terms of investigating. I didn't have to get in a plane. But I became friendly with one of the detectives. Again, this is a serial killer, Kendall Francois, and he would kill these women and bury them in his house. Not bury them, store them.
Yeah.
And I was in the courtroom when he was sentenced. And New York does not have the death penalty. So, you know, they did for 5 minutes, but then they got rid of it. Well, I listened to the victims' families deliver victim impact statements. It was very, very emotional. Very, very, very emotional. I remember that vividly. And then I remember looking at Francois. I certainly was not as close to him as I was to Hilton, but the vibes were completely different. I mean, Francois gave off bad vibes. You know, Gary didn't do that. This guy gave off bad vibes. And I went down the streets where he picked the women up. I think I talked to at least one of the prostitutes. It was pretty upsetting.
Absolutely. Yeah, it reminds me of the case in Cleveland where that person, again, it's incredible to think that people could keep rotting bodies, not like Gacy in a basement where some of the smell would be contained, but rotting bodies in a home piling up.
Well, and in the case of Kendall Francois, he lived with his sister and his parents, and none of them, they all claimed they didn't smell anything because the place was very dirty. You know, I'm not going to get started, but it was just, you know, and I remember looking at the house, photographing the house. I think at one point it was, I'm trying to remember if I got in. No, I don't think I did. They sold it eventually. In New York, they have a law that you got to tell people, you know, if murder took place, you got to tell them. But anyway, and it was just a very, what do you call it? Very average, ordinary, middle-class neighborhood. You wouldn't have thought of anything out of the blue, you know, out of the ordinary, rather.
Yeah. You took a little bit of a detour in true crime for people. Most people would stick to the same serial killers and those types of killers, but you wrote a book, I guess this was co-authored too, Born to the Mob. Tell us a little bit about Born to the Mob and co-authored this book.
Oh, boy. That the only reason that book happened was because I had an agent at the time that put me in touch with a guy who had contacted her, wanted to write a book named Frankie Saggio. He had been a member of the Bananos, and he was actually a member of all the crime families because he was an earner. And
right.
So I got together with him. Oh boy, that was a very tough book because I made the mistake of trusting him.
Right.
And that was a big mistake. Once in the mob, always in the mob. You know, that's what their values are. And so, you know, I wrote the book with them. I got to tell you, I would never, ever, I shouldn't say never. Sean Connery did that once. It didn't quite work out. But I wouldn't go looking for another mob book. It doesn't interest me one way or the other. I'm not interested. I know too much about it. You know, I think that's part of it. I think when you're writing, you want to learn something. You know, I don't need to know the intricacies of the mob families. I know all about that. I'm more interested in the other stuff. You know, why do people do what they do? Who are they? That sort of thing.
Yeah. Let's talk about something that was close to your heart. You had thought about it and conceived of it long ago, and this was a subject that you wanted to write about, and you finally did in 2019, Bat Masterson. Tell us a little bit about Bat Masterson and why this story, this book, is so important to you.
Thank you, Dan. Oh, well, this book is so important to me because I wanted to write a book about this guy for 40 years. And it's taken me a long time to put it together why it's percolated for so long. And I realized what it is, which is this. I started out watching a TV series about him called Bat Masterson, starring Gene Barry. But then I did my research, and I found out he came to New York at the turn of the century. I found this out in the 70s. He came to New York in the 1900s and became a reporter for a local paper. Well, but then I found something else out. I found two things out. First was Masterson was involved in the most sensational murder case in New York State history, which became the basis for the trial of the century, involving a guy who allegedly, drowns his fiance because he doesn't want to marry her. Well, that became the basis for Dreiser's novel, An American Tragedy, and later the film A Place in the Sun, starring Montgomery Clift, Elizabeth Taylor, and Shelley Winters. But in every single iteration, what they got wrong was that Bat Masterson covered the case and solved it for this newspaper. I mean, he knew what happened, okay? And he actually was very upset when Chester Gillette, the alleged murderer, was convicted, and he wrote an article about it with a headline, New Style Lynch Law in Upstate New York. And when I found that out, and then really just in the last couple of years, I became the only one to find out that Masterson was an illegal alien. It had been reported for a long time. He was born in Quebec province, but nobody ever reported he was an illegal. And originally when he came to America, the borders were open, but then they changed it. That's one of the things I learned. And so I said, I have to write this book now because of what my country is going through. And what was really educational was, with all of the criticism being leveled at the current American president regarding his way of treating immigrants, it turns out there's nothing new under the sun. This has been going on since Millard Fillmore was president, going back into the middle 1800s. There's always been problems, but I felt like I had a responsibility as an American to tell Masterson's story now because he's considered to be an American legend.
Yeah.
And also, I'm friends with you, so I wanted to tell you, hey, this guy's a great Canadian.
Now, so what I wrote in... Go ahead, sorry.
No, so that's it. So I wanted to write it, and I finally was able to get it, to do it. And there's seven murders in the book. There's seven different murder cases, which is pretty cool.
Absolutely. Now, what I mentioned in the introduction was that we were going to discuss how you got started, and we did talk about that. But what cases in particular, and cases and killers included with those cases, most shaped your remarkable true crime body of work? Which, talk about just briefly about some of the cases that really were pivotal in your writing career, either changing or reinforcing or moving your career ahead?
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Wow. That's a hell of a question. Well, certainly the first one is going to be would be Lobster Boy.
Mm-hmm.
Lobster Boy. And Flesh Collectors. When I wrote Flesh Collectors, I didn't mention this. I told the DA on the case. I said, I don't know if I can write another true crime book because of the way that they killed this young girl. And I had at that point my daughter was, she was young, but not that young. But the point is, I had some identification. You know what I mean? And
sure.
So I said, I don't think I can write another true crime book. And the prosecutor says to me, Fred, I hope you change your mind. I said, why? And that's when he said to me, Fred, we speak for the dead. That changed me.
Mm-hmm.
That really changed me. It gave me an impetus. I mean, right now, for instance. Right now, I mean, I'm investigating Natalie Wood's death. But the reason I'm doing it is because I don't know anybody else is doing it. She deserves justice as much as anybody else. So
sure.
that certainly had a lot to do with it. I'll also say that when I wrote the Atlas of Crime, it got me into writing about history. And I think... Yeah, I didn't realize at that point, because everything I had done I'd written to that point was current cases. And I
right.
think for some reason I hadn't thought about historical true crime. And that turned me around, you know, and got me looking at historical true crime. Which, you know, it's so interesting. You know, what bothers me is when somebody is convicted of a murder and they didn't do it. And that's
sure.
where, you know, did they really do it? The idea came about for that. But, you know, until a couple of years ago, I didn't know. There's a song called Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley.
Right.
Folk song by the Kingston Trio. Well, I had no
mm-hmm.
idea Tom Dooley was a real guy.
Yeah.
And his real name is that's the way they pronounced it. But it spelled it differently. But that's not the point. The point is, you know, I look at it and I, you know, when I start reading about these cases, I go, gee, nobody ever said this. You know, and it goes back to what we were talking about before, which is after a while, you know, it's like they say in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
Yeah, yeah. We talked about, you mentioned an early influence in your writing, and I'm curious as well, I'm sure the audience is curious, how much of a role, or what was the role of this Lawrence, this editor that you talked about, and other editors at Pinnacle and HarperCollins, in sort of being able to capture your true voice, and also just, I guess, urge you to, or the end product, to be very, very concise, a very, very enjoyable, I can say easy read, but a read where you're wanting more at the end. Tell us about
okay.
who shaped this, some of the shaping of the style of the books.
Well, actually that goes way back. it goes back before I became a true crime author. That goes back to film school. I learned how to write in film school. That was the first place where I found out in my early 20s that I was a writer. See, up to that point, I thought everybody could write.
Right.
I didn't know. I had no teachers who encouraged me, but when I got to grad school and I was at USC, I was taught to write film. And so I took, even though film, of course, is different than print, I the same techniques of move the story along. Story's got to move. You know, and I learned that also. I'll tell you, I learned a lot of that, you know, in terms of how to write from people that I read. And I'll tell you who I learned the most from, probably. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And, you know, an incredible writer. And then later on, Raymond Chandler. I read all of these mystery novelists. And, you know, and I thought I was going to do I thought I was going to do fiction, but then I got the opportunity to do nonfiction and true crime. And I took to it, you know, like, you know, whatever. And it really, it's been good. You know, of course things have changed, you know, like Paul Dennis, who I mentioned earlier, was a terrific editor, but that's it. As far as any other editors, no, there's nobody. I will tell you one thing, quick story. I have become friends with a writer named Allison Adams. Why? Well, at a certain point, at a certain point, I started investigating her father's suspicious death. Who's her father?
Okay.
Nick Adams. Nick Adams was one of my childhood heroes. He played Johnny Yuma, the rebel, on ABC TV, and he died from an apparent drug overdose. And I started watching the old shows, and it turned out that in the show, the character of Johnny Yuma is a writer. And I started thinking to myself, gee, could that have influenced me? You know? And I felt, again, I felt an obligation to help out Allison, which I did. And in fact, she wants to do, I think you may have talked to her at some point, she wants to do a podcast. Nick was certainly an early influence, and we mean early. In terms of writing, but really in terms of structure and stuff like that, I learned all that at school. You know, I learned all that at school. And but when it comes time to, you know, it's from Conan Doyle that you find out, you know, you got to talk to people when you're doing this work. You know, you got to talk to people and put it together and use logic, you know, and so forth.
Yeah. What is down the pipe for you? What are you working on now, or what do you hope to work on? What is the subject matter that you may want to work on? What is next for Fred Rosen?
Oh, boy. You ever get tired of asking me difficult questions?
No.
It's a good question. All right. I want to do – there's a murder case that somebody told me about out in Louisiana. The problem is that they got one guy, but there's probably other guys that did it. And there's a really good, there's a possibility that some of the officials in the parish are involved. So, you know, I try to stay out of dangerous situations. You know what I mean? When somebody wants, if somebody wants to hide something. Now, that's one thing. I definitely, just as we're talking, I'm going to keep going with Natalie Wood and see what I can find out. I don't have any, you know, I don't have any
place I'm going with it, because it's that's an incredible. How the heck do you prove that a woman was shoved into the water by her husband when she's got when the autopsy shows she's got bruises all over her body? How do you do it? You can't. You know, you can't. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm gonna keep. I'm gonna keep investigating. And the other thing I'm going to do is I want to do a. I've been thinking about this. I keep going. You know, I keep going back to my childhood, but there must be a reason. And when I was a kid, there was a miniseries that Disney did. Disney pioneered miniseries, by the way. You know, Davy Crockett was a miniseries.
Sure.
But he did a miniseries in the late 50s, early 60s, called The Nine Lives of Elfego Baca. Elfego Baca was a Mexican-American lawman, a legend. And I just think that would be a very, very good true crime book, because one of the things I discovered was that in one of the cases Baca worked on in the 1890s, he used forensics to solve the case.
Well, yeah.
You know, but also, you know, these days, you know, I don't want to get political, but I think it's relevant that in this Mexican American woman, oh boy, they discriminate against him. They tried to kill him. You know.
Yeah.
So I would like to do something on him.
Sure. America might be ready for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fred, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about all of the books that you've written, and we've missed a couple that you've co-authored, and you have some crime files, and we could go on some more about other things that you've written. But these are the major 18 works of your body of work, these 18 books that I urge people to go to. These serial killers, as we know now, it's at the age of spree killers and one-off killers and those kinds of killers. So these books, in essence, become true crime classics because of the killers, because of the investigations, because of the forensic limitations at those times, enabling these serial killers to go on and on and on. I want to thank you very much, Fred, for coming on and talking about all
your books. I want to thank you so much for this retrospective. I don't have words. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Is there, can people refer to Amazon page, but do you have a website in case people might want to contact you? Tell us how people might contact you or look at other work.
FredRosen.net.
There we go.
That's it. Just either go to Amazon or, of course, Facebook or FredRosen.net.
You're all over the place, yes.
Well,
thank you so much, Fred.
All right. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much, Fred.
Take care.
Talk to you again
soon.
Good night.
Okay. Adios.